Welcome to GeekWire, everybody. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop, and I'm here to introduce the first in a pair of special episodes that we'll be featuring on the GeekWire podcast this week. We'll be looking at the world of computer science and technology through the lens of the Paul G. Allen School for Computer Science and Engineering in Seattle at the University of Washington in advance of its commencement on Friday, June 14th. Tomorrow, we will have a conversation with Hank Levy, the outgoing director of the Allen School. And today, we're speaking with the noted computer scientist who will be delivering the Allen School commencement address this year. Here's GeekWire Civic Editor Monica Nicholsberg to introduce our first guest.
Dr. Maria Clave is a noted computer scientist, former Microsoft board member, and president of Harvey Mudd College. She'll deliver the commencement address at the University of Washington Allen School for Computer Science and Engineering later this week. She joins us on the phone for a preview of her remarks and a discussion of the broader trends and challenges facing the technology industry. Dr. Maria Clave, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
You're about to deliver the University of Washington Computer Science commencement address. What's the overarching message that you'd like to get across, that you'd like students to walk away with?
I think that what I really care about their thinking about is the fact that computer science is impacting every aspect of society. So graduating with a degree of computer science, it's both a huge privilege and a huge responsibility. One of the things that the University of Washington is particularly committed to is making sure that people who graduate in computer science represent all aspects of our society. So there are women, there are LGBTQ, there are people of color. I mean, it's just one of the things that if we're going to have a technology that is having such a huge impact on everything that happens in the world, you really want to make sure that all demographics are represented in the people who are going to have the opportunity to solve problems and have so much impact. And so that's, I think, the biggest thing I want to say is that, you know, you're really fortunate to be have learned this knowledge, to have this opportunity to have so much impact with your lives. But with that comes this huge responsibility to actually care about what that impact is. And part of making sure that happens is making sure that we have diverse people who have access to this knowledge.
When you say it's a big responsibility, what do you mean by that? Or what do you expect these new graduates to do with the skills that they've learned?
One of the things that I think is really different today from, say, 15 years ago is that when you graduate with this, with these skills and knowledge, everybody wants to hire you. Healthcare, finance, retail. It's not just the big tech companies or even the startups that want to recruit you. It's every aspect of society. So one of the things you have a choice about is you have many job offers, as many as you want, and you get a chance to think about how you want to use this knowledge. And so the responsibility is thinking about, what do you want to use this for? I mean, do you want to design better ways for students to learn? Do you want to design ways for the finance industry to make more money? Do you want to work on healthcare solutions? And, you know, there are just so many possibilities of what you can do with it. And it's not that I'm saying that jobs in one sector of the economy are more important than jobs in other sectors. But what is important is that when people are making choices about the jobs they take, that they think really hard about whether the skills and knowledge they bring to the job are going to be used for improving society or for something that we would probably mostly agree is to the detriment of society. So, for example, if you are a data scientist, and many computer scientists these days understand a fair bit about machine learning, algorithms, automation, all of those kinds of things, you could think about going and working for a company like Cambridge Analytica, not that it exists anymore, but that is going to basically pipe fake news to try and influence elections in a negative way across the world. Or you could go and work for a similar kind of company that is basically trying to make sure that that can't be done, to prevent that from being done, and making sure that democracy actually functions effectively. And it's those kinds of questions that I would like graduates to think about, as not just today as they're, you know, accepting their first job in their career, but as they go through their career, choosing where they want to use their skill and their knowledge. And do they want to put their weight on the lever that is making the world better? Or do they not want to care about that? And, you know, I think one of the things I love about the University of Washington is that I know that, you know, for a long time, that head department has really cared about these issues. And so it's one of the reasons that I'm going to go give the commencement address.
And then those questions get even bigger when you think about some of the technologies of the future. I mean, artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, there's so much interesting stuff going on right now in computer science. I wonder if you were in these graduates' shoes, what path do you think you would take today?
Well, so that's actually a really interesting question because more than 40 years ago, I made the decision to learn computer science, having just finished my PhD in mathematics. And what I decided was that the demand for the computer science knowledge was so much greater than the demand for mathematics, even though the kind of mathematics one would use in computer science was closely related, that I decided to learn the computer science so I would be able to work at the interface of both of those fields, because I figured I could have more positive impact in the world if I did that. So if I were starting out today, the areas I would be focusing on would be machine learning, AI, data science, and the ethics and social responsibility that are integrated with those disciplines. And you know, one of the things I feel really good about is that Harvey Mudd, for the last 60 years, has been worried about educating engineers, scientists, and mathematicians who understand and care about the impact of their work in society. Today, a number of much better known institutions like Stanford and MIT are just starting to think about this. At MIT, it's with the Schwarzman College of Computing. At Stanford, it's at the Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. But, you know, from my perspective, if you really want to think about how technology affects what happens in the future and the kind of world we have, that's what I would focus on.
And you've accomplished something pretty extraordinary at Harvey Mudd. You have 50% of your graduates with degrees in STEM are women. That's science, technology, engineering, and math. And compared with the national average of 21%, that is a pretty big accomplishment. How do you think you succeeded where so many other institutions have failed?
Well, I think that the real answer to that is that our faculty decided that this was an imperative. And it's really, you know, it's not that hard to attract and retain women and people of color in areas like computer science and physics and engineering, where they tend to, you know, be somewhere about 20% of the graduates. And we have been running at close to 50%, even over 50% occasionally in computer science, physics, and engineering. But it's all about how you teach, how you present the discipline, the kind of learning environment you create for your students. And what we found is that if you start out from the very beginning with your introductory courses, making it clear how the concepts that you're teaching actually have impact in the world, so not only emphasizing the rigorous theoretical foundations, which are really important, but also the application areas, if you make sure that all of your students feel engaged and supported, then it's really not hard to attract underrepresented groups, and it's not hard to retain them either. And so, you know, the credit goes to our faculty because we did a strategic plan in 2006. One of the six themes in the strategic plan is unsurpassed excellence and diversity at all levels at Harvey Mudd College. And so that was a commitment to diversifying our student body, our faculty, our board. Obviously, when we diversify our student body, it results in our alumni being diverse as well, which is very important. And our faculty made that a priority. And so they have done a lot of work trying different approaches to pedagogy and curriculum to make this work. And it works. And so one of the things I'm very excited about is that we are now working with, you know, a couple of dozen universities across the country on sharing some of the things that have worked at Harvey Mudd. And that's also a partnership we're in with University of Washington. They are one of our partner institutions for the BRAID, stands for Building, Recruiting, and Inclusion for Diversity. We're celebrating the fifth year of BRAID. They are what we call one of our beacon institutions, which means that they are, we recruited a handful of beacons to work with us. They are institutions that have done a lot of work themselves on attracting more women to major in computer science. And, you know, the fact of the matter is it takes work and leadership and consistent application, but it's not particularly difficult to change this. And so, you know, one of the things we're promoting everywhere, other universities and in industry, is if you really care about diversity and inclusion, you will make progress because it's not that hard to do, but you do have to actually do the work and be consistent about it.
But there are still people who are deeply skeptical within the world of computer science. There was the Google engineer who published the manifesto about women not being as predisposed to computer science as men. And there was actually a University of Washington computer science professor who kind of echoed those sentiments in the past couple of years. And I wonder what you tell those people who basically think you've done the impossible at Harvey Mudd.
Well, the first thing I say is, let me show you another set of institutions that range from small to absolutely huge who've done the same things as we have and are seeing similar results. So, you know, one of my favorites is the University of Illinois at Chicago. Unlike the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, it's not very well resourced. Almost all of the students who attend UIC are working part-time jobs to support themselves through going to college. They tend to be first generation from immigrant families, et cetera, et cetera. They've made a huge amount of progress. I showed them the New Jersey Institute of Technology, another university with similar demographics. Again, they've made a lot of progress. You know, so often when I talk about Harvey Mudd, people say, oh, well, they have a female computer scientist as president. You have elite students. You know, you have so many advantages. And my point is that through the BRAID project, we have demonstrated that lots of different kinds of institutions, if they do similar things, they will attract women, they will retain them, they will graduate, they will be successful in jobs. So, you know, I grew up being somebody who absolutely loved math and heard constantly. So I'm 67 this year, I'll be 68 in July. And so I grew up at a time when everyone said girls weren't any good at math. And, you know, I heard this constantly as, you know, I was the best student in my high school. I was one of the best students in my university in math in a decade, et cetera, et cetera. And people were saying girls can't do that. Well, now, you know, it's pretty clear 30% of our PhDs in math are going to women. We have, you know, Marion Mercer County, who was the first woman to win the Fields Medal. We have so many demonstrations of how many talented female mathematicians there are today. And the same is true for computer science. So it's just a matter of time before, you know, we get rid of all of these myths about women not being genetically or biologically predisposed to be good at certain areas. The truth of the matter is, if you teach curriculum appropriately, if you provide appropriate levels of learning support for all of your students, you will see all of your students be successful.
You're listening to GeekWire, and we'll be right back.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Maria Clave, president of Harvey Med College. Can any of the lessons that you've learned through this success at Harvey Med be applied at the grade school or high school level to increase women in STEM fields?
So I guess one of the things I should make clear about women in STEM fields, if we talk about science broadly, women already make up half of the bachelor's degree recipients or even more. And the only thing is they are mostly in biology and chemistry. They are tend not to be in, and they also make up 42% of the math graduates as well. So, you know, it's only a small number of areas of science and engineering where women are underrepresented. It's most areas of engineering, not bioengineering, and less so in chemical and civil engineering, but it's areas like mechanical and electrical and computer and nuclear and aerospace engineering where women are underrepresented, and it's computer science and physics. One can certainly do similar things throughout K through 12 to make it clear that girls and boys excel in all of these areas. I think the most difficult challenge, however, at doing it at that level is that there is still social pressure for girls when they, you know, go into high school not to be seen as excelling academically in math and science. And it's sort of like, you know, pretty girls don't do that. Socially popular girls don't do that. And so one of the problems is if you get girls interested in elementary school and middle school, and then all of a sudden they go through this sort of social shift when they get into high school, unless you're able to turn them around at the college level, you've probably lost them. So my own feeling is, even though it's important to do things in K through 12, and I certainly support doing that, the biggest opportunity is to get young women as they enter university, because if you get them turned around in the first couple of years, if you get them into industry internships, if you show them how creative and fun and interesting and impactful learning an area like computer science or engineering or physics can be, then you graduate them in that area and they're much more likely to actually enter, you know, the workforce as a computer scientist or engineer or physicist. So I applaud efforts to do things at K through 12, but if you really want bang for your buck, focus it on universities.
I wonder what your perspective is on the headwinds that women face after they graduate. You were on stage with Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, at Grace Hopper when he advised women not to ask for raises, but to rely on good karma instead. And he later apologized for that, and you were clear that you disagreed with him. I'm just curious, what are your reflections on that moment almost 5 years later?
One of the things I think about that moment is, first of all, that was one of the best things that ever happened for Microsoft. Because Satya came back, well, at least for women at Microsoft, but I think it's also part of, you know, they're currently the most successful tech company in the world. They have the largest market cap. It's just been incredibly successful under Satya's leadership. And I think at least a part of that, certainly not the only thing, is they came back from that Hopper conference with a new understanding of what diversity and inclusion actually meant. And I hear from so many women at Microsoft, oh my goodness, Maria, you have no idea how much better things are in the last 3 years than they were before that happened. That doesn't mean it's perfect, but I know for sure that Satya, Kathleen Hogan, who's the EVP for HR, Amy Hood, many of the other leaders at Microsoft, they think of this idea of being able to attract diverse people, make them successful, retain them as one of their top levers for success that they have. And I am just so proud of what has happened at Microsoft in the last several years. I don't want to say it's perfect. We know at Harvey Mudd, we're not perfect. We know that we can get better every day, and that's true for every company. Another company I want to mention is Accenture. Alan Shook is the EVP for HR and leadership at Accenture, and a number of years ago, in fact, probably about 6 months after the interview with Satya at Hopper, I was giving a talk at a conference called HR50, which is they bring together the leaders of HR at 50 multinational companies. And I was talking about how to recruit and retain more women in tech positions in your company. And I was talking about really basic things like how you advertise a job, the words you use, you know, things like saying, we're looking for people with outstanding creative and communication and people skills in addition to technical skills in the following areas. But if you emphasize creativity, communication, and people skills, they know, women know that you are a company where they will appreciate the fact that you bring those in addition to technical skills. And so will men. So, and then talking about the interview process and talking about how you retain women, all those kinds of things. And Ellen, what I didn't know was this was her first week in her new job as EVP for HR at Accenture. And she came up to me afterwards and she said, you know, Maria, we hire 17,000 software engineers a year in India, and we're coming in at 30% female, and I want to get that up to 45%. And you gave me some really good ideas to try, really concrete, practical things. I saw her 4 months later. She comes up to me and she says, Maria, we came in at 42%. And the only things I changed, female, the only things I changed were we now recruit at women's engineering colleges, because in India, a lot of parents of young women don't want them to go to a co-ed institution, but studying engineering is very popular. We changed our interview process, we changed our ads, and we came in at 42%. And, you know, their goal is that they, by 2025, they're going to be at 50-50, male and female in their company. They've been coming in at over 50% female in all their technical hires for the last 4 years. They have also changed their promotion procedures, and they're seeing a significant increase of women moving into the partner level. So the answer for industry is the same as the answer for higher education. If you want to do it, if you're intentional, if you learn about best practices, it's not that hard to change things.
Right. There's actually a Seattle startup that's working on just that. It's called Textio, and they use AI to analyze job listings for for language that might put off underrepresented groups.
I know about that. That's Kieran Snyder, I believe, is the CEO.
Yep, that's right.
Yes, that's a great initiative. And it's actually partly because of knowing about that, as well as another startup that is no longer around that was doing similar things, that made me start talking about that when I talk about how companies can change. And, you know, we do it, one of the things we do when we're advertising for faculty, so we are 50% female in our computer science department for faculty. For students, yes, as well, but for faculty. And one of the things we do when we advertise jobs is we ask for people to provide a statement about their vision for their research, their vision for their teaching, and also their commitment to diversity and what they do about it. And we found that just by asking for that, it makes it much more likely that people who are really committed to diversity will apply to our department. And as you know, it's a very challenging time to hire computer science faculty because there's such high demand and relatively low supply because so many PhDs in computer science are now going to industry because it pays so much more, et cetera. But we found that when we really are intentional about what we're trying to do, we don't have so much difficulty in attracting women into faculty positions, women to our board. We're now about 40% female on our board as well, which is up from about 10% when I arrived. So, you know, the basic idea is if you want to do it, learn what the best practices are and do it, and you will succeed.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about the areas where Harvey Mudd might be able to improve, because I know that about a decade after you joined, you had what you described as the hardest year in your professional career. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges you faced that year and how you dealt with them?
Yeah, well, I'll just say that this year turned out to be even harder. So, you know.
Wow.
one of the things that happened at Harvey Mudd is In the time that I've been president, we've gone from being about 30% female in our student body to about 50% female. And we've also, in the last 6 or 7 years, we've gone from being about 1% African American to now being about 5% and close to 10% if we also count multiracial who have one parent African American and students from Africa, but 5% African American and from about up from 1% and from about 5% Latinx up to now about 20% Latinx. So that's a really big shift over a relatively short period of time. And I think one of the things that that we talk a lot about at Harvey Mudd is it's one thing to attract students and, you know, have them join the college, come to the college. That's not easy in itself. That took a lot of work and a lot of learning what we needed to do to be able to attract those students to Mudd. But it's an order of magnitude more work to make sure that the experience they have, whether it's in courses, in dorms, just in the general learning environment, is as supportive as our traditional student body, which would be white males and to a somewhat lesser extent, Asian males. And so we have had to sort of examine just about everything that we do in how we teach and our curriculum to try to make sure that we are addressing the needs of all of our students. And, you know, that the year that that happened, that was in the fall, in November, Trump was elected. There was a lot of angst, I would say, among people of our students of color, our faculty of color, our LGBTQ community, faculty and students, our female students, our immigrant students. I mean, there was this a sense of anxiety across the entire nation. And we had in almost every campus was dealing with some kind of unrest. And we had a very unfortunate we had a student of color die of an overdose in February of the school year, and he was beloved. And we didn't know that it was an overdose because there was a machine that was broken in the coroner's office in Los Angeles County, and it took them 4 months for them to tell us that it was an overdose. So there was a lot of belief that he had actually committed suicide. And then 3 weeks later, we had a student suicide at the college across the street, which is called Scripps College. And that was an African-American student, and that was clearly a suicide. And the sort of rhetoric went around the Claremont Colleges that the Claremont Colleges are so hostile to students of color that they have to kill themselves to get attention. And it just, we had protests and demonstrations happening on every campus. And it's an interesting situation. We have 5 small undergraduate colleges, but the students know each other. And if anything blows up on one campus, it ricochets to the next one, and then to the next one over, et cetera. We also had a staff person who was telling our students of color that our faculty were racist and that they didn't want them here. And we didn't know that that was happening. And then finally, we had had a review team come to talk to faculty and students about issues related to, you know, some of the difficulties in making the transition to a more diverse student body. And when the report was published, the faculty made the decision not to share it with students. And it got leaked to students. And there were a number of quotes from students and faculty that were very, inflammatory, let me put it that way. And so all of those things happening at the same time, just the place went crazy. And we eventually, so we had protests, we had demands, we had, you know, all the kinds of things that, because we're happening at many other campuses across the country. But it was particularly painful because we had worked so hard to diversify our student body and our faculty. And for the faculty who'd been trying like crazy to handle the situation with the loss of the student who had died from an overdose, and, you know, it just felt like we were going through a family tragedy, but we're also dealing with all of this anger that we didn't understand at the time where it was coming from, and eventually it became clear. But the thing I would say about that was it was intensely painful for everybody involved. But we actually came out of it a better community than we were when we went into that academic year. And it did cause a lot of changes to happen. And, you know, I think we were, when we started in the fall of 2017, after that very, very challenging spring semester, I think we were terrified that students would come back and go sort of straight back into protest mode. But instead, people came back, and I think we're in a generally much more, you know, sort of positive frame of mind and more willing to work together on things. And I think we've actually made real progress since then.
Are there lessons from that very challenging year and those experiences that you'd like the broader computer science community to learn?
I think the thing I would say is that no matter how hard you work on anything, there will be setbacks. There just are always challenges. And I think the most important thing I personally learned out of that is, you know, when these things happen, you have to support each other, you have to help everyone move forward, and you have to stay true to what your mission is and your goals. And I think that's what got us through that. It's what has got us, I mean, just in case you're wondering why this year was so challenging, we had a student suicide right at the beginning of the semester, and we're such a small place. We have less than 900 students, so we're a very tight-knit community, and it was a very, very difficult thing to go through. So, you know, I think the thing everyone needs to remember is there are always challenges. No matter how well you prepare for them, there will always be challenges. But that if as a community you try to support each other and move forward, you will make it through those challenges.
Well, I think that is a great note to end on. Dr. Maria Clave, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure talking with you, Monica.
Thanks for listening.
Tune in tomorrow for a conversation with Hank Levy, the outgoing director of the University of Washington's Allen School for Computer Science and Engineering.
For more, go to geekwire.com/podcast. I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm Todd Bishop.
And we'll talk to you next time on GeekWire.
This GeekWire podcast is sponsored in part by Yale University Press. Are you concerned about the rise of AI and how it will impact our society? Every day, artificial intelligence presents us with urgent ethical challenges. How do we harness this extraordinary technology to empower rather than oppress? Nigel Shadbolt and Roger Hampson have written a how-to for building ethical machine intelligence. Their new book, As If Human, Ethics and Artificial Intelligence, is now available wherever books are sold.